You're listening to Groundwire, national news from a grassroots perspective.
You have to help people heal. There is a reason that people commit crimes.
I don't know why students would vote for a politician who consistently ignores their issues.
And just for me as an Anishinaabe Kwe and a mother, I feel like it's my responsibility and my duty to protect that water.
This episode of Groundwire was produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, a cooperative community radio station which broadcasts on Seneca's traditional territory.
Our first feature was contributed by Michael Welsh of CKUW in Winnipeg, who spoke with people attending the Anishinaabe Water Walk in opposition to construction of the Energy East pipeline.
We'll also hear from Megan Thomas, who spoke with Letters for the Inside Project coordinator Lisa Orton as part of CJSF Radio's Prison Justice Day coverage.
On the community radio report, Ome Salma Rahemdla brings us Victoria Fenner in conversation with the National Campus and Community Radio Association's new executive director, Barry Rook, on the topic of new media.
That's all coming up in this edition of Groundwire, but first, here are the headlines. Students and their student unions voice concerns that the Fair Election Act will deter the student vote. Carly Forbes brings us this headline from Thunder Bay.
In July, the Canadian Federation of Students lost a court challenge and a subsequent appeal in an attempt to have the Fair Elections Act ruled unconstitutional in advance of the federal election. I spoke with Roman Jacobowski, Lakehead student and student union president, about this issue and how the student union will be supporting student access to voting.
So the big change is that now you'll be required to provide proof of address. So if you're a student and you don't live in Thunder Bay initially, you moved up here, you'll have to get a proof of residence if you're living in residence in the university, or maybe you could use your lease, a telephone bill. There are a lot of options. The problem with the legislation is that elections are really fought on the margins. So if you've ever heard Bridget DePapp say that the last conservative majority was won by 6,000 votes in 14 battleground ridings. So there are a lot of options as to how students can vote. There are plenty of ID options available. But, you know, the reality is that this will stop a couple people, and it will have a big impact overall. So we're going to make sure that I just ordered 2,000 cards from Elections Canada. So we're going to make sure everyone knows what the ID requirements are, the new, how they can prove their address, what they need when they come to the polls. But more importantly, I think we're going to make sure that politicians are taking the time to actually talk to students about their issues. I don't know why students would vote for a politician who consistently ignores their issues.
SRO tenants in Vancouver file one of the largest residential tenancy complaints in BC history. Catherine Fisher tells us more.
On Thursday, August 13th, 93 tenants of the West Hotel on Carroll Street in Vancouver released details of their landmark joint residential tenancy complaint, one of the largest in BC history. Tenants are seeking $70,000 in compensation from hotel landlord and building owners for multiple violations of the Residential Tenancy Act. Tenant Evelyn Brazee says that everything went downhill when new owners Navtej Bains, Sukhvinder Grewal, and Amarjit Mann of 0955803 BC Limited bought the hotel 3 years ago and hired management company Community Builders Group. Brazee said that previously, quote, "Everything was nice here. Everything worked. It was nice and clean. The elevator would break down periodically, but they'd get on the phone right away and get it fixed. It's not like that now. I broke my ankle on the stairs while trying to get back to my room. The bathrooms are always broken down. The only thing they listen to is money. So we're going for compensation and hope that that makes them take us seriously and fix this place up." End quote. When the new landlord took over, they cut back on staff and the drug dealers outside the building moved in and squatted in bathrooms and hallways. Tenants estimate that every night there were about 30 people who didn't belong in the building, trashing the building and terrorizing the tenants. In March, a double homicide happened. Tenants are seeking compensation for the time they went without adequate staffing at the hotel. Tenants are also requesting that the residential tenancy branch remove the management company Community Builder Group's self-designated status as transitional housing in order to stop them from operating outside of the rules of the Residential Tenancy Act.
Prison Radio CKUT contributed our next headline about access to voting for prisoners. Joan Ruza from Rittenhouse reported that last election, several prisoners did not receive ballots until 3 days after the election. She provides detailed information for prisoners in the federal system on how to exercise their right to vote. Rittenhouse seeks healing justice through community education around alternatives to prison and advocacy and support for prisoners, ex-prisoners, and their families.
The way it works in the federal prison system is that there's a staff person, they're called the liaison officer. And that person should be helping you to register to vote and to actually vote. So that person should already have been chosen because the election has been called. So if that information isn't being sort of displayed publicly, if it's not easy to find out who that person is, my suggestion would be that maybe you check in with the inmate committee. They should be able to tell you what's going on there. The way it works is when you're in prison, it's basically like an absentee ballot. So you're voting like anyone would vote when they're not in the riding where they live. So there's four different ways you can vote. If you don't know what your riding is, there's four different ways that can happen. So the first one is the place that you lived before you were incarcerated, so that address, or the residence of your spouse, common law partner, any other relative, where you would be living if you weren't incarcerated, so that address. And if you don't have either of those things, you can also use the address where you were arrested or the address of the courthouse where you were convicted. When you have one of those addresses, you then obviously need to find out what riding that is, which is going to be challenging. So hopefully you have someone in the community who can look that up for you, find out what the name of your riding is and what the names of the candidates are. If you don't, there's actually a special 1-800 number specifically for people who are doing what's called special voting. And I called Elections Canada. They said it's a universal number, so you should be able to call that number from any federal prison. And the number is 1-866-222-2565. So the full list of candidates in the different ridings won't actually be out until the 30th of September. That's the date where you can find out who your candidates are in your riding. Because you're voting by absentee ballot, you basically vote 10 days before the actual election to make sure that your ballots get counted on time. So that means that you should be voting on the 9th of October. And what should happen is that a polling station should be set up in the prison, and whoever that liaison officer is that I was talking about, they should have helped you register to vote. You have to fill out a form called an Application for Registration and Special Ballot form. And then on the 9th or whatever the day is that they put up the polling station, you'll basically get a blank ballot, and you have to fill out the name of the candidate that you're voting for in your riding.
Thanks to CKUT, CILU, and CJLY for those headlines. You can visit our blog online at groundwire.ncra.ca. We'll be right back. On this episode's Community Radio Report.
You might be listening to Groundwire right now as a podcast and even as a Rabble Radio podcast. The radio and media landscape in Canada has changed significantly in the past 5 years, widening the reach and diversity of community voices. The National Campus and Community Radio Association's new executive director, Barry Rook, spoke to Victoria Fenner from Rabble Radio about what campus and community radio is doing to integrate new media into what has traditionally been one-way communication over a transmitter.
Well, I think you're seeing a lot of it, exactly like you said, using networks like Rabble.ca, using online hosting and allowing for opportunity for individuals that are producing content to have that second step involved in it is now not just one-way broadcast directionality. It's you're talking about the opportunity for social media. You're talking about the opportunity to have full extended interviews available. Sometimes you're talking YouTube and video clips. This additional types of mediums that are being used allow for just so much more information and so much more opportunity for people to interact with each other, which is something we haven't seen. And it's adding a very new element to the community side of things. Again, it's not that one-way directionality. It's really starting to bring people together. And you see it in the discussion forums, and you see it in the way that people are producing their content as well. It's not, here's an expert individual of this time who's speaking about one topic. You're bringing in all sorts of views and opinions from, you know, across a small geographical location or from around the world. And it's what that new types of broadcast options are allowing people to do. So I think they're really closely connected. And yeah, I would agree that a service like Gravel.ca is quite an extension to what campus community radio stations do and what the programmers do, but it's also a very necessity on its own.
Do you have any sense about how many of your listeners are now listening to FM and how many of them are listening online? Is FM, is it still even relevant anymore, do you think?
It is. It's very relevant. Technology itself, specifically in Canada, hasn't caught up when it comes to, say, a digital audio broadcasting system or something along those lines. So FM or AM is still a very popular way to listen to, especially when people are on the go. I think the podcasts are becoming more and more relevant. The on-demand opportunity to go back to listening to a podcast where you can throw it on your smartphone or your laptop and take it with you and listen to it, or the ability to say if you're at work and go, oh, I haven't heard this show or I'd like to listen to this, to click on a link and stream it on demand is growing. And I think that's where a lot of the niche programming is coming out of, and that's where a lot of the niche programming is getting its recognition from.
Yeah, so now, are many of the stations that are members of the NCRA, are they getting into podcasting as well, or is it mostly just streaming the radio signal?
The connection to the podcast side of things, where you're actually running it through a podcast service, I think some of the stations are trying to encourage their programmers to use a service like that to get additional listeners. I think a lot of the individual shows that are on these stations take it upon their own to generate those podcasts either in advance of the programming, and they just replay what's on the podcast on the FM, or vice versa, record it live and then cut and edit and then upload to a podcast. So it really depends on the individual programmers, but I think you're seeing more and more, mostly because it's easy to set up nowadays. And it's exactly like what we talked about earlier, where it allows those programmers more ears to listen to and gives them another sense of a set of community that they're trying to develop towards, which I think is, again, really important to encouraging quality production across the board. And most organizations or groups that use it and do both, I've seen have been really happy with the opportunity to present their content.
Right, this is a really good time to put in a plug for what for Groundwire, and also we have programs on the Rabble Podcast Network that are podcasts based on shows that are at some of your member stations. And that's one of the things that we really, really cherish and very much appreciate, is this relationship that we have with community and campus radio stations and also the NCRA through Groundwire.
That was Barry Rook, the Executive Director of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. He was talking with Victoria Fenner, and she spoke to him from the National Office in Ottawa.
Thanks to Ome Salmarahemtila for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. Groundwire will be back after this music from BC sound artist House of Rain. Welcome back to Groundware, a biweekly nonprofit national news program produced by the community for the community. Groundware is heard on dozens of community radio stations across Canada.
And now for our feature stories.
Michael Welch of CKUW in Winnipeg spoke with people attending the Anishinaabe Water Walk to stop construction of the Energy East pipeline earlier this month. The walk started at Eagle Lake and ended at Shoal Lake in northwestern Ontario.
Planned months in advance, the Anishinaabe Water Walk attracted about 36 First Nations women and men and their allies over the course of a week, starting on August 2nd, coincidentally aligning with the first day of the federal election campaign, and ending August 8th. They would travel for about 30 kilometers a day, stopping along the way to camp for a total of 125 kilometers. Indigenous teachings were very much at the heart of the action. What you're about to hear are the voices from the walk recorded over the course of that week.
My name's Crystal, and I helped to organize this water walk from Eagle Lake to Shoal Lake, Ontario, Treaty 3, Anishinaabe territory. It's been a while now, maybe a couple years, since we first heard about the Energy East pipeline project. We've been opposed to this for quite a while now, and a lot of people I know are also opposed to it. So we have a number of people from different communities. Like, there's somebody who joined us from Eagle Lake today. We have people from Grassy Narrows, people from Shoal Lake 39 and 40. What we're doing is we're building unity between different communities and meeting other people that are also opposed to the pipeline and want to protect the lands and the waters. So out of this, I hope that this is a catalyst towards further organizing.
Daryl Retzky from Shoal Lake. There is a fear that, you know, there is no guarantee that there would ever be any safeguards to prevent, you know, oil and water doesn't mix, right? So obviously, if anything is going to happen, I think we're going to be the first community that's going to be impacted, you know, immediately. And shortly after that, it's going to be the city of Winnipeg that'll feel the effects of any accident, you know, if that event should occur. With this water walk, I think it's a good idea because, I mean, it's the women of our territory now who are making a stand and making that walk, because the women of our nation, I think it goes into any culture and any color or race, the women are always the one tasked with looking after the water as life givers.
My name is Patricia Big George, Chief of Anishinaabe of Naungashi. We're worried about our future. You know, not necessarily our future, but, you know, our children and our grandchildren. What's going to be left for them? I personally think that everybody should take a visit up to the tar sands, you know, and everybody should see what's happening there and what's happening to the people, what's happening to the animals, and because that's what's going to happen here.
My name is Clayton Thomas Mueller. I'm a Cree man from Pugadawagan First Nation, Treaty 6 Territory in northern Manitoba, and I'm an Indigenous climate campaigner with 350.org. For me, I feel very strongly that the federal election provides a tremendous opportunity, but I also am already looking past the election because, you know, I, like many other First Nations, am a sovereigntist, and whether it's a Liberal government or an NDP government or, you know, another 4 years with the Harper Conservatives, they all have a fiduciary and legal obligation to the First Nation peoples. And one way or the other, you know, that is going to be honored. And, you know, I think that Harper has made things so bad, you know, on the reservation, and he's embarrassed Canada on the world stage with the treatment of the Native, especially in the refusal to honor the call for a national inquiry into murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. And that issue is the dark underbelly of Canada's extractive industries-dependent economy. You know, when you dispossess Indigenous peoples from their land because you destroyed it through industry, and Indigenous peoples become urbanized and you don't have the social safety net to support them in that radical transition, horrible things happen. This walk through Treaty 3 against the Energy East pipeline is part of dozens of ceremonies happening across the country that will lead First Nations peoples to a much better place.
The walk came to a close on the afternoon of Saturday, August 8th, on the powwow grounds of Iskatawizagagan, Shoal Lake 39 First Nation. The walkers were then invited to the powwow's grand entry. Lead organizer for the walk, Christy Swain, from Grassy Narrows First Nation, was invited to speak about the recently concluded walk.
My name is Christy Swain, and I'm from Grassy Narrows. We started this walk last Sunday from Eagle Lake to here, and we thought it would be a good route because of the proposed pipeline. And one of our concerns, I guess, is, you know, the spills that have been happening all over Turtle Island with these pipelines. And right now in the world, we have a small percentage of the cleanest water left in the world. And just for me as an Anishinaabe Kwe and a mother, I feel like it's my responsibility and my duty to protect that water so that our children will have a future and that so that our children can still have life after us.
From Winnipeg, in the heart of occupied Anishinaabe Aking, homeland of the Métis and traditional territory of the Neowak and the Nakota, this is CKUW contributor Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Thanks to Michael Welch and Victoria King at CKUW for that Groundwire feature.
Check out past editions of Groundwire. Visit us online at groundwire.ncra.ca. We're always looking for new contributors. Contact groundwireprod@gmail.com for more information.
Groundwire continues our August 2015 Prison Justice Day coverage with our final feature. Letters for the Inside is a permanent project of the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group in Burnaby, BC. Student researchers respond to requests from prisoners, and their aim is to increase inmates' access to information and to provide a better quality of life on the inside. CJSF's Megan Thomas spoke with Letters for the Inside coordinator Lisa Orton about the work of LFTI and the larger prison context in Canada.
Letters for the Inside offers volunteers the opportunity to respond to prisoners' requests for information. Prisoners from all over Canada, but primarily in BC, write into the program with one or several topics to be researched. Their letters are photocopied, coded, and put into binders, where volunteers can find them whenever they have some free time. Volunteers read out the letters and choose one that appeals to them. They research the topics using the organization's vast library and online resources, and then send the prisoner what they find. The range of requests the program has received over the years reflects the diversity and dynamism of the prison population. Here is part of a conversation between Megan Thomas and Lisa Orton about the program and about the prison industrial complex in Canada.
In the statement that you provided from Prison Justice Day, one of the things they talked about is prison as punishment. So rather than trying to remove people from active society that have shown that they, for one reason or another, can't participate safely, basically, and especially when you think about serious violent offenses, because, of course, the softer offenses tend to be a little bit more about political wind than about danger to society. Rather than trying to make them be able to function in society again, often that system actually impedes even worse. You know, people, there's a stereotype that people come out of prison better criminals.
Absolutely. I think if we're not doing anything to help people change how they've worked or, you know, changed what they've done or the reasons that they've done things, it's just going to go back to the same. You have to help people heal. There is a reason that people commit crimes, and we need to help them deal with the circumstances that put them there in the first place. You know, one of the reasons that I got involved was because of the high amount of First Nations people in prisons, because I'm a First Nations person myself, and every year the amount of Aboriginal population is increasing, and I would like to see more of an Aboriginal restorative justice model applied in prisons, and I think that would make a big difference.
You know, it's not the only group that is overrepresented in prisons, and they tend to overlap with the people who are overrepresented in poverty.
Absolutely. When you dig into it, it's definitely it's the marginalized people from every demographic that are being affected and that end up in the prison system. It's how the social structures of our society work.
So how do people get involved with the letters from the inside and appear at SFU, Simon Fraser University, and what are some of the things that they're going to be doing?
Well, it's actually very easy. You get in touch with SF Perk, or you can email letters@sfperk.ca and ask about volunteering. We do a 45-minute orientation, and you choose whichever letter that appeals to research, bring it back, and we send it out. And this is an ongoing project at SF Perk, so we're always there.
So you have to be a researcher already? Is that something that you should already be doing as a student? Or what are the kind of qualities that you're looking for in participants of the program?
Well, no, you don't. Students and community members are welcome. And basically, we don't do too in-depth research, just giving answers to sometimes often simple questions. It can be health history, the arts, writing or publishing, or just song lyrics, poems or drawing patterns. They can be relatively simple and easy to do, or we have more complex ones. And we have a big letter binder full of people who have written in looking for answers.
Who your prisoners are? Ooh, 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 Canada, do you know where your prisoners are? A 16-year-old in an isolation cell only learns one lesson, but by God, he learns it well.
Thanks to Megan Thomas from CJSF and Catherine Fisher from CJLY for that Groundwire feature.
And that's all for this edition of Groundwire. Groundwire is a grassroots news program brought to you by the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
All of our episodes are available for listening and podcasting at groundwire.ncra.ca.
This edition was hosted and produced by Catherine Fisher of CJLY on Sinek's traditional territory in southern interior British Columbia. Thanks to Yvette Jansen for narration, and Ome Samarahemtula and Carly Forbes for other assistance.
Groundwire thanks episode contributors Michael Welsh, Victoria King, Carly Forbes, Catherine Fisher, Megan Thomas, and Ome Samarahemtula.
Music was provided by House of Rain and Kathleen Yearwood.
From all of us at Groundwire, thanks for tuning in.